John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Narendra Modi is an overwhelmingly popular leader of India, 1 billion plus. His election recent past left many to assume that big changes were coming. Sadanand Dume of the American Enterprise Institute, publishing most recently at the Wall Street Journal, looking at Modi, the early days, what we would call the first 100 days in an American changeover. But this is different governance, and Mr. Modi's party, the BJP, has been out of power for a long time. So important decisions have to be made right away, not just about big legislation and big challenges to institutions, but also to how the BJP is governed. Sadanand, a very good evening to you. I want to begin, before we plunge into the problems of Modi's India, with a new person to me, Amit Shah. Who is he, and what's the significance of his choice by Mr. Modi?
Amit Shah is Mr. Modi's right-hand man. Now, this is a person who was kind of seen more as a backroom operator, the guy who Modi would go to, Modi's Mr. Fix-It, if he needed anything done. Amit Shah was the one person who he is known to trust implicitly. And what's significant over here is that at a very young age, he's only 49 years old, Amit Shah has been propelled to the presidency of the BJP. And what this means is that Modi not only controls the government of India as a very powerful prime minister, but now also effectively controls his party. So he's the most powerful prime minister in 25 years, and he's the most powerful party leader in the history of the party.
This concentrates the power in two politicians from one place, if I understand this correctly, Gujarat. Is that a weakness or a strength in India with all the different governances of the states?
Well, I think Modi is betting on the fact that he was elected from the Hindi heartland state of Uttar Pradesh and really has a pan-Indian presence and image at this point. He's not seen as merely a Gujarati leader, though he indeed is from Gujarat. But I would rephrase that slightly. I would say that it concentrates the power in one person's hands, because Amit Shah is significant less for being Amit Shah and more for being Modi's hand-picked president of the BJP.
All right, he's got the man he wants. Now plunging to the challenges. And the first challenge I want to mention is left over from reporting in these last years, which is electricity, energy. There's said to be a shortage of coal at the energy generating plants, and coal, Sadanand, we're looking at a product that has been, if not banished, certainly castigated in America, and India is depending on it, and it doesn't have enough of it. Is this a constant problem I'm just discovering? And is Modi a part of the solution, or does he just have to manage with it?
Modi is definitely part of the solution, and it's not really a classic. It's not a supply problem in the sense of India not having enough coal. It's a supply problem in the sense of the previous government having got the policy all mixed up. And so there are all these brand new coal-fired power plants that are ready to produce energy, and India faces severe energy shortages. But the coal is owned by a state-owned company, and there are just difficulties, in fact, getting the coal to the power plants. And so this is one of those classic log jams that you would expect someone like Modi, who's earned his reputation as a good administrator, to fix and fix quickly.
I want to mention another problem I've learned of recently, and we've discussed this, which is sanitation as a way of talking about India's curse of malnutrition for many poor people. As I understand it, the sanitation problem is longstanding. It's tradition. It's customary. However, it leads to childhood afflictions that leave children, and when they grow up, vulnerable to diseases, to pandemics, and also impossible to get enough nutrient, even if there is enough food. Is this too large of a problem to ask governance for? Is this about cultural changes that must take place over many generations?
I think it's both. I think the first stage is really recognizing that there is a more intelligent way of looking at malnutrition than simply calories, which has been the traditional Indian way of looking at it. And that malnutrition, that sanitation really is the key. I mean, I'll give you one pretty startling statistic. There are about 1 billion people on the planet who do not have access to toilets. 60% of them live in India. And so the challenge really is twofold. One, in many cases, we're talking about in rural areas and so on, it's building these or better still, getting people to build them themselves because they're invested in it. And then the secondary order challenge is to get people who are habituated to actually begin using these and understanding the importance of this for their own communities and often for their own children.
A quick detail here. The new science points to the fact that the bacterium in open toilets damages the lining of the intestines of infants. And once that lining is damaged, it is very difficult to absorb enough nutrients, even if you have enough food. So therefore, that leads to malnutrition, which leaves, as adults, very vulnerable to pandemic and weakness. And you don't get the growth of the brain, intelligence, and all the skill sets you do when you have good sanitation. I want to go now to the budget, because that's what you focus on in your Wall Street Journal piece. You use the word underwhelming. You're disappointed in Mr. Modi. What is he looking on in his opposition? He has this power in the legislative branch. Why is he hesitating about being aggressive with his budget?
Well, I think the most charitable explanation is that these guys are only 6 weeks in, and the BJP has been out of power for 10 years. And so they've just come in and they have to pass this interim budget. This is not a budget for the whole year. And they've chosen to do a few things. I believe they could have done more. They could have, just in terms of messaging, they could have been bolder. They could have, for example, scrapped a retroactive tax that was put in place in 2012 by the previous government. They could have captured the headlines by just doing a few things more aggressively. So my sense of this is that, yes, this is an underwhelming budget. However, there are other reformist measures in the pipeline. And if those go through, then this budget will quickly be forgotten. And if their next budget, which is only 8 months away, hits the right notes, then I think it would be a good start.
The markets were overexcited about Mr. Modi, and now they're underexcited about Mr. Modi. That's about right. Markets sell off, and then they buy too much. They have a bubble. That's fine. But right now, Mr. Modi is taking on everything at once as a miracle worker. That's unfair to him. What would you say his priority is? What can he do in the first year that would demonstrate there's a new way for India?
I think the most important thing is to show that he has reestablished reliability in the business climate, that this is a stable place. It may not always be the fastest moving place, but that he has made it stable again and that he is pushing through reforms in a sustainable way. And I think that's going to be his focus, because it's very clear that this is someone who wants to be a two-term prime minister at the very least, and he's not going to be a two-term prime minister unless he keeps his promise to fix the economy.
Fix the economy, and that is a long-term project? Can he do that in 5 years and satisfy?
Yes, I think that he can certainly set the economy on the right path in 5 years. Does this mean that India will be a wealthy country in 5 years? No, of course not. But can he restore it to the high growth rates that we had seen just a few years ago? Not so long ago, just about 4 years ago, India was growing at double-digit rates, and everyone was speaking of India in the same breath as China. The great example in Asia of democratic capitalism to rival the authoritarian capitalism of the Chinese. He has to recapture that, and he can do it. But if he has to act firmly and quickly to do it.
Sadan Dandume is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and he's a columnist for WSJ.com, publishing most recently at The Wall Street Journal. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. Rikers Island, December 17th, 2012, right before Christmas. An inmate, unnamed, flooded cell block 13B, which is a solitary confinement unit in the George R. Vierno Center at Rikers Island. It delayed dinner. The inmates were very unhappy. There were loud remarks, inmates and guards facing off. What followed, a report from Michael Schwartz and his colleague at the New York Times, looks like the fog of war, because violence proceeded. does this point up to a larger problem at Rikers, a larger problem with corrections officers? Michael, a very good evening to you. The facts become immediately vague, but that is the nature of confrontation. What do we believe happened following the flooding of the cell block? Good evening to you.
Good evening to you. Basically, what happened is you have a very tense situation in Rikers that evening, and for whatever reason, we don't quite understand, the correction officers singled out two inmates, Tamal Dixon and Andre Lane, and basically one after the other extracted these individuals from their cells, strapped them to, handcuffed them to gurneys, took them down to a medical wing where there were no cameras, and as horrified medical staff looked on, proceeded to beat both of them very, very severely.
Beat both of them, and there were witnesses. Is that correct? At one point, there one of them appealed to a witness, "Don't leave me. They're going to kill me," if I follow your story correctly.
Correct. The medical staff were present in the clinic, and this is you know, these are not isolated cases. This is the case we chose to highlight because of the stark facts and what we were able to uncover. But in numerous cases, we found the same, where beatings occurred in clinics or occurred in stairwells, in full view of witnesses, some of whom tried to intervene and were unable to do so.
Mr. Lane was also beaten, so both were beaten in some fashion. And,
correct.
And they have testified to that, or there is testimony to that. I note also, before we do the larger picture, two captains of the correction guards were present, so it wasn't just regular working guards, it was supervisors.
Indeed.
That seems strikingly irregular. Especially because they're in front of medical staff. Is there an understanding that the medical staff would not talk? Is that the presumption? We can go where the cameras aren't and not worry about witnesses outside of our command?
Well, I mean, as you see here, some of the medical staff did talk, but yes,
right.
there is, when speaking with a lot of the civilian staff in there is a fear of speaking out, because really these individuals depend on correction officers for their safety inside the jails, and kind of speaking out against them, there is a fear that there could be some retaliation.
You, at the Times, and you write this with your colleague Michael Weinrip, have acquired a secret report, if I follow this correctly, a secret internal study completed this year by the city's Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. What did that report describe? What are the scales of the metrics?
Sure. Basically, this report took a look at 129 different cases when inmates received severe injuries at the hands of correction officers between January 1st and November 30th, 2013. It was able to tell a number of things. One of the most striking things it was able to determine was that 77% of the inmates in the study were classified as mentally ill.
And the Rikers Islands guards, move to the correction sides, are they accredited to deal with mental illness? Is that part of their job training, that sometimes you're dealing with irrational behavior?
Every correction officer receives about 38.5 hours of training at the academy when they just come on the job. The new correction commissioner, Joseph Pond, has said that training will increase by 8 hours, plus they get refresher courses, I believe, every year. Both they will claim, and mental health professionals will claim, that they do not have the proper training for dealing with particularly the large numbers of mentally ill inmates that have currently started gathering within the jails at Rikers Island.
If I follow correctly, the violence has been increasing at Rikers these last 5 years, but not just violence against inmates report, also violence against correction guards.
Correct.
So what we're looking at is a battlefield that's getting worse each year. Is there a general explanation for this?
Explanations vary. The changing nature of the population inside is one of the examples. There are various measures, but the Department of Correction, the Department of Mental Health, have determined that about 40% of the jail's inmate population at any given time suffers from some kind of a mental illness. That's up from about 20% 8 years ago. So that's changed the nature of how that requires different types of procedures for de-escalating conflicts, which correction officers may not be equipped with. There are also problems with gang violence, which continue to bedevil any solutions, and so that's one of the drivers of violence.
I note that correction officers are credited with having used force on inmates 1,927 times in the first 6 months of 2014. Is a correction officer obliged to fill out a report every time he or she uses violence or confronts an inmate with a violence?
They're supposed to. It doesn't happen in every case, but as you can tell, it happens in a significant number of cases.
My puzzle here is, what's changed? Because when I was a younger person and I was at seminary, I traveled to Rikers Island. It was a volunteer program. You went out and you dealt with people who were looking to get appeals or get documents. And there was nothing seriously involved in the people I dealt with. They were all very straightforward. But Rikers, although gloomy, was not presented to me as a battlefield. Now, that was 40 years ago, so I'm very much behind the times. But what you're describing in this report, Michael, is a failure. This is a failure that's looking to fail the more. There doesn't seem to be any bottom here.
Well, that's unclear. The mayor has signaled his desire to address the problem. He's appointed a very reform-minded commissioner, Joseph Pont, with a mandate to get control over the jails and to shake things up, to bring in more mental health programming, to reduce the use of punitive segregation, solitary confinement, and replace it with less punitive measures for dealing with infractions. I asked the mayor about this report, and he reiterated that he has full confidence in the commissioner to bring about these reforms. He's also created a task force that is going to more broadly look at the issue of mental health and how it intersects with the criminal justice system. This will naturally occur. This will include the situation at Rikers Island, but also include the situation regarding the arrests of people with mental illness. So what is driving mentally ill individuals into Rikers Island? And that task force is supposed to be coming out with a report or at least some initial findings in September. So there are things that are moving. We're at a kind of a wait-and-see moment right now.
Michael Schwartz and Michael Weinrip of the New York Times reporting on the violence at Rikers in two directions, against the inmates and against the corrections officers. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. John Batch. I will be reporting from Israel under rocket barrage next week. To learn more, podcast always ready at johnbatchelorshow.com. John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Bob Zimmerman, he keeps the website Behind the Black, is here because we're looking at a recovery of an old satellite, a 20th century satellite, and this is an adventure. There are episodes in which we think it's lost. Now it might be back, or maybe. IC3, Bob, how are they doing? What is it?
IC3 was an 80s science probe that was supposed to study the sun and the solar wind as it approached the Earth. It was converted into a Halley's Comet Observatory, which put it into a different orbit. And now it's coming back to the Earth, and there's a private group of geeks who are basically trying to fire its thrusters to get it back into its original orbit and where it can do its original science work. And they've had mixed results. It wasn't working. They fired the thrusters. They tried to fire its thrusters to change the orbit, and nothing would happen. They thought at first that they had failed. There was nothing. There's no more they could do. But they put out a call to the engineering community, and they got a gigantic response from some real experts. It says they wouldn't say who, but people who actually helped build this rocket, this spacecraft back in the 80s. And they then tried again earlier this week on Wednesday to see if they could fire the thrusters again, do some things, plumbing clean out. Basically, you think like a carburetor, it's clogged, and if they do like shake it a little bit, they could clear the lines. That's very metaphoric, what I'm saying. Well, they tried on Wednesday, and they had mixed results. They seemed to get some instances of thrust, they said, that indicated that some thrust was happening, but it wasn't enough. And so they've gone back to the community, discussed it again. They're going to try again tomorrow. That's the next window using Arecibo, the radio telescope. And so they're going to try again and keep playing with this. They have a little bit of time before it's too late to move it. So there's still a chance they could save it, John. It's not known yet whether they will.
Bob, we have V'ger, actually called Voyager 1, and the debate for some time has been whether it is or is not in our solar system. Why are we debating this?
It's science. It's basic science. The solar system, where is the dividing line, the border leaving the solar system? It's not like the Mexico-American border where it's a line, you know, with a fence or a river. It's a fuzzy position, and Voyager's out there, and they think it's moved out beyond the edge of the heliosphere. That's the area dominated by the sun's solar wind. They think they have solid evidence to suggest that periodically the heliosphere, the wind blows stronger, and it sweeps past Voyager, and then it shrinks again and Voyager's out into interstellar space. That's why they've been claiming it's out into solar space, because of that data. However, other data says it's not in interstellar space. The theory had been once it got out of the heliosphere and outside the influence of the solar wind, it would also be outside the influence of the sun's magnetic field, and they would see an abrupt change in the magnetic field lines. It would no longer be following the magnetic field of the sun, but that of the galaxy, and that would be the angle would change drastically and somewhat quickly. But that hasn't changed at all. It's exactly the same. So it appears the spacecraft's still under the control of the magnetic field of the sun, but it's outside the heliosphere, the solar wind's influence. This wasn't predicted. It's not understood. Scientists are fighting over it. And it's part of the uncertainty of science, you know. This is a very far away and faint amount of information, and we haven't been there before. So we're just trying to really learn the geography of the solar system and how it interacts with our galaxy. That's essentially what's going on right now.
And we all know V'ger will return someday to star in Star Trek 1 with Kirk and Spock. Rosetta is a European probe, and it's approaching a comet, but a discovery. What is it, Bob?
Well, we really do not have. We've had a bunch of spacecraft go past asteroids and take a lot of pictures. We've had one orbit an asteroid. We've had another one land and bring back a little bit of sampling. But we have not really had very many missions come close to comets. Halley's Comet had the most observations back in 86, but none of them got really great pictures of the nucleus because it was very active and very fuzzy. Rosetta is approaching a comet right now, and its rendezvous is going to be in just a couple of weeks, and they're going to land a probe on it in November. It's going to orbit this comet for a period of time. I'm not bothering. I'll call the comet 67P. That's part of its name. The rest of its name is this very complicated Russian two names. It's too hard to pronounce. So 67P is the comet they're approaching, and they finally got close enough, about 10,000 miles, where they could take pictures of real detail. And what they found is really a surprise. And it's the first good images of a nucleus of a comet, and what it looks like is it's two objects that have stuck together. It's very strange looking. It looks kind of like a duck, but it's like one piece that's long and narrow and another piece that's kind of like oblong, more like square, and they're stuck together. And so they're talking about this might be what they call a contact binary, where it's two objects, separate objects, that kind of like pull themselves together and kind of attach themselves to each other. Oh, this is not expected. They don't know what it is. They're going to have to do a lot more research. It complicates the landing scenario in November because they were going to spend a month or two observing the comet and then pick a landing spot. But now they've got what looks like possibly two different environments entirely. Which one do you choose to land on? You might get very different results in each place. And so this is going to be an interesting problem. The bottom line, no matter what, here is this is real good new science. We're finally getting to look at something we've never looked at before. And not surprisingly, as always, it doesn't look like anything we expected. And that's what makes a science exciting.
I recommend you go to Bob's site. There's a link to the glimpse we have of the comet. And you can see quite clearly there's a distinction between one hemisphere and another hemisphere, whether they're joined, whether it's a contact binary, whether this is being pulled apart as a rubble pile, whether this is about evaporation, all those things are to be discovered. Now to Curiosity, our favorite little robot in the Gale Crater, opportunity, and we don't mean to offend you in any fashion. However, it's passing a meteorite, a six-foot-wide meteorite on the Martian surface. Is it going to linger, Bob? It's headed up to the mountain.
They haven't said. It's unclear. But what's really cool about this is that this is a pretty big object. It's 6 feet across. They took show pictures. I posted the pictures on Behind the Black. You can go to the webpage and just see the pictures, as well as the Rosetta comet, the weird duck-like contact binary. It's a big object sitting on the surface nonchalantly. You wouldn't see this on Earth because a meteorite like this would immediately be sampled by, you know, humans use the metal for various objects for decades. But here it is, it's just there. And it's big. And so, this suggests a great deal about the surface of Mars. This is not the first meteorite that's been spotted by a rover, but this is a big one. The other ones have been small like rocks. So, it does suggest that as exploration gets more sophisticated on Mars, we're going to see things like this more frequently, and that's going to give a great opportunity to study the solar system, because rather than going to an asteroid, you'll be able to pick up meteorites, which are asteroids, quickly and easily on the surface of Mars. I don't know what Curiosity will do. They have they have to balance their forces. They want to get up to Mount Sharp. That's its primary mission.
Bob, it's been some time since you've updated us on Curiosity. You had concerns about its wheels, about friction. Has there been anything new from NASA about this?
Basically, they have the problem is they've got to be very careful where they pick to drive. And they've been doing that to try to save the wheels for as long as possible. They are faced with the fact that they're entering actually rougher terrain now. They're just going to have to keep an eye on it and try to deal with it as best as they can.
Off to Mars with manned space, but this time it's from an unusual source, United Arab Emirates. That's right, the Gulfies want to go to Mars. Do they say why, Bob?
This is a very Soviet style, the typical thing. We are going to save the world. We want to show how we do great things to inspire, and the Arab people can make to humanity through great achievements a contribution. And that's from the His Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, Vice President and Prime Minister of the UAE and ruler of Dubai. Dubai is very interested in a lot of this stuff. You know, they're one of the backers of Virgin Galactic, so it doesn't surprise me that they're trying to do this kind of stuff as well. They say they're going to have an unmanned mission to do science in 2021 on Mars. We'll see. They don't have the infrastructure or the technical community there to do this. So to start from scratch is not easy. I'm kind of skeptical. I do, though, applaud them for choosing to build spaceships and explore the heavens rather than trying to kill Jews, as some Arab activist groups try to do in the Middle East.
Caves of the Moon, just a brief note, Bob, because you are a person, an enthusiast for climbing in the Earth's caves. Have you found new ones on the moon for yourself?
I haven't. I mean, back in 2011, I did a lot of stuff on the website, and you can still see those links where we and James Fincannon, another engineer, did actual research finding cave locations. But what has happened is some scientists, engineers, have used the data from Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, and they have actually now accumulated a database of 200 caves on the moon. And so this work is now getting more seriously looked at by scientists, and these are important because this is where we will eventually stay when we get there.
Quickly, Bob, a spotless sun. What does this tell us? 30 seconds.
30 seconds. Well, we've just we've gotten the first blank sun since 2011. The sun has not been blank in 2 plus 3 years, and that's because there's been sunspots continually going through the solar maximum. Well, the solar maximum is starting to ramp down, and very suddenly, almost overnight, the sun went from having sunspots to none for the first time in 3 years. And so that's almost certain proof that the sun maximum is beginning to end, heading towards minimum.
Bob Zimmerman, he keeps the website Behind the Black, and he'll cave on the moon soon enough. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. Climate change. The Obama administration committing itself to fighting, resisting, reversing climate change. The politics of this are a Byzantine, and at this point, it is not clear that anything, in fact, will happen, but there's a lot of finger-pointing and a lot of blame-shifting. Liz Peek, writing most recently at the Fiscal Times, is here. To enter into this question of how the mass media, especially mass media reporting on the news of the Obama administration, is handling a debate that is not, to my knowledge, settled. Liz, a very good evening to you. Let's establish a couple of things. Climate is not weather, and weather is not climate. Therefore, if it is cold today, that is not about climate change. If it is hot today, that is not about climate change. Nor is a hurricane about climate change. Climate is global, takes place over a long period of time. It requires great patience, and climatologists are scientists. They never come to a final conclusion. They always gather data. That's how they get grants. All right, we've stipulated that. The Obama administration has plunged us into what I would say is a political remedy to climate change. And how are they doing, Liz? A very good evening to you.
Good evening to you. It sounds like economist. look, I think the issue that is on the table, one, is how Americans are viewing climate change and what kind of information they're being sent on this. And it has become, as you say, increasingly politicized and increasingly also now censored. We have numerous organizations, the BBC being the most recent, that will not even air or publish the other side of the climate argument, the other side being that man-made industrial activity has not, in fact, irreversibly changed the climate of the globe. So I dislike the honesty of this, and I think it's very costly to have arguments shut down because we are, in fact, as you point out, not only in the U.S. but around the world, implementing policies to deal with climate change that are extremely expensive. Most recently, of course, the Obama administration called on the EPA to promote new regulations to curb emissions out of power plants. Well, the upshot of that will be higher electricity rates for Americans, less competitiveness in versus our global manufacturing alternatives, people in Germany, Asia, et cetera, who don't have the extraordinary resources, inexpensive resources that we do in this country. The interesting thing is we had yesterday Australia with a conservative government elected largely on this topic, decide to throw over their carbon tax, which has been in place for a couple of years, has been very unpopular in that country. And it's just sort of the most visible example right now of a country that has found that it is a true penalty to pay to accede to the environmental movement and to tax carbon, restrict carbon, whatever, a decision that has made largely on, you know, sometimes sort of cosmetic reasons. And so finally, their government decided, no, we are not going to shelter this cost, what their prime minister called a $9 billion handbrake on their economy. And remember, it's a much smaller economy than ours. We haven't yet arrived at that point in the United States. The Obama administration thinks we should be ladling on costs and raising our power costs. In a quest to, as you say, abate climate change. But at least we need to be talking about this like grown-ups, and at the moment we are not.
Liz, does this mean that the BBC, the LA Times, the Popular Science magazine will now refer to Australia as the denier takeover of the Australian government? Is that what's going to happen now? We color Australia in as deniers.
Well, Certainly the media is going to be handling this as a real blow to the environmental movement. There's been a lot of pretty hysterical quacking about how there's never been a country that has backpedaled on its carbon initiatives, et cetera. And that simply isn't true. Spain actually has done so. Spain was a country widely touted by President Obama for having had the courage to subsidize renewable energy, wind farms and green energy through solar panels, et cetera. And then Spain decided in 2010, I think it was, that they couldn't afford this any longer. They already were in trouble budget-wise. The government was spending too much money. And one of their universities did a study saying that for every green job produced, using Spain as evidence, the United States would lose 2.2 jobs on average. So this is not a winning look. It's all about the economy versus a long-term benefit, presumably for improving the climate. And I think that the problem is that the merits of that long-term gain are not particularly visible. Americans certainly don't see them at this point.
When we were children, Liz, Mom and Dad's all told us wolf, wolf. Wonderful story. You remember it your whole life.
Of course.
It's burned into the imagination. I'm struck in your Fiscal Times piece how you point to Salon, which is in a distinguished publication of the left, associated with the Washington Post, and that's a distinguished publication of the Obama administration, publishing an article that features dengue fever, higher pollution levels, rampant valley fever, Lyme disease, and mosquitoes, including the Asian tiger variety, throwing in attacks of brain-eating amoebas, all linked to climate change. Now, I understand this sounds like The Onion, but that's Salon. At this point, television would say they've not just jumped the shark, they've eaten the shark. They've eaten all of the sharks.
Well,
let's pull them back a little bit. The people of Australia are not welcoming dengue fever. Can we get them to admit that?
I think we can. Look, I think the alarmism has been so extreme. As you point out, there's a difference between weather and climate. NBC News two nights ago started their broadcast by mentioning that 39 million Americans were at that moment experiencing extreme weather. What did they mean by that? Heavy rain, thunderstorms, etc. Don't you remember going back to, again, when we were children, summer thunderstorms are pretty common. And if you, in fact, do any research on all the things that are now being attributed to climate change, whether it's wildfires or droughts or hurricanes, the truth is the numbers have not budged. There is not a case to be made that there are more wildfires or tornadoes or hurricanes because the climate is shifting. And by the way, there are many, you know, the newest rallying point on this is that 97% of scientists say that this is so. They believe in man-made global climate change. The truth is, a survey of hundreds of those scientists that were polled said that they, yes, they believe that there was some change taking place. They do not believe that it's this extreme crisis that it's being made out to be. And you know, as you point out, there are a lot of vested interests here whose welfare and whose grants and so forth depend on scaring the dickens out of Americans and out of people in other countries as well. The thing is, it's been overdone, and I am offended by the lack of honesty here.
Liz Peek, writing for the Fiscal Times on the climate debate, the climate change debate, and the first and, of course, most significant victim of the dengue fever, wildfires, mosquito brain-eating amoebas is this personality called Keystone XL Pipeline. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show.